It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. And today on the show, bucking the system, including a system like policing.
My first real encounter with police was one through the television, 1985, in the city where I grew up.
This is Philip Atiba Goff. He's the co-founder and president of the Center for Policing Equity.
I was 7 or 8, and what I remember were sort of like cut scenes from the movie of my life. I remember we had a small black and white television in the kitchen of the duplex where we lived.
Philadelphia was also the scene today of an armed confrontation between the police and a radical political group called MOVE.
It was May 13th, 1985 in Philadelphia, when a police helicopter dropped two bombs onto a compound housing a black liberation group.
And I remember seeing row homes that we knew on Osage Avenue on fire. And I was asking what was going on. I remember my mother saying, kind of in the same kind of daze, they bombed the people. I said, who bombed the people? She said, the city bombed the people. And then hearing over the television, we don't know why they're not putting the fire out. My father saying, they don't want to put the fire out.
A police helicopter dropped a percussion bomb on top of the fortified row house. The bombs apparently started a fire that in the past 3 hours spread to 4 other homes in this middle-class West Philadelphia neighborhood. Thousands.
My parents tried to have, you know, normal dinner table conversation, but it would come up. It was like the world they were trying to keep us safe from had entered into our home during those conversations. And so the MOVE incident in Philadelphia is one of the sort of foundational, fundamental touchstone incidents in my entire life. And I'm confident that that helped shape a great deal of my perceptions of law enforcement and public safety, the whole nine.
Philip carried those perceptions with him all the way through college.
So when I got started, I graduated college in 1999.
Another tragic incident between the police and a black man made national news.
Amadou Diallo was shot by the New York Police Department, by officers in NYPD, 41 times. They had given him instructions to identify himself. He got back to his own residence, pulled out his wallet. They swore they saw a gun. They shot and they killed him. Now that, if you want to assume that they're not lying, and I don't assume one way or the other, but if you want to assume they're not lying, that kind of error, literally seeing something that wasn't there, something that was consistent with the negative stereotype about black people, it was an important kind of error that psychologists were studying at that time. We were at the height, or even maybe still in the upswing, of what social psychologists call the cognitive revolution, where we're applying the tools of cognitive psychology to social phenomena.
It was the combination of those factors that led Philip to get a master's and later a PhD in social psychology and work to understand how racial bias affects the way police behave.
So we started to do some studies on this automatic association between black and criminal and the ways it literally tunes our vision so that we see the world in stereotype consistent ways.
Mm.
But I think to me, the most important thing to understand about it now, in the late 90s, we were having a national conversation about whether or not racism was over. It was as dumb then as it is now, but we were losing the conversation. How can we have racist outcomes if explicit prejudice is on the decline?
Hmm.
And so part of the project in that moment was to develop language that made sense of the fact that you can have racism without explicit bigotry.
And this is a really important point because these studies, the ones that you just mentioned, they found that when people who didn't consider themselves racist in any way, if they were shown a picture of a person with dark skin, they were more likely to assume that that person was a criminal. And this research in the 90s, it laid the groundwork for a lot of what we talk about today when we talk about racism, this idea of subconscious or implicit bias rather than explicit bias, right?
Yeah. So when we talk about the popularization of implicit bias, it was rigorous science about how the world works, but it was also science in search of language for something that people were experiencing but didn't have language for, which is pervasive discrimination that didn't have the same sort of blacks only, colors only labeling on it that it had just a couple of decades before.
Philip Atiba Goff picks up this idea from the TED stage.
The most common definition of racism is that racist behaviors are the product of contaminated hearts and minds. And when you listen to the way we talk about trying to cure racism, you'll hear it. Right? We need to stamp out hatred. We need to combat ignorance. Right? It's hearts and minds. Now, the only problem with that definition is that it's completely wrong, both scientifically and otherwise. One of the foundational insights of social psychology is that attitudes are very weak predictors of behaviors. But more importantly than that, no black community has ever taken to the streets to demand that white people would love us more. Communities march to stop the killing because racism is about behaviors, not feelings. And even when civil rights leaders like King and Fannie Lou Hamer used the language of love, the racism they fought, that was segregation and brutality. It's actions over feelings. And every one of those leaders would agree, if a definition of racism makes it harder to see the injuries racism causes, that's not just wrong. A definition that cares about the intentions of abusers more than the harms to the abused, that definition of racism is racist. But when we change the definition of racism from attitudes to behaviors, we transform that problem from impossible to solvable, because you can measure behaviors. And when you can measure a problem, you can tap into one of the only universal rules of organizational success. You got a problem or a goal, you measure it, and you hold yourself accountable to that metric. So if every other organization measures success this way, why can't we do that in policing?
You decided to collect data to measure police behaviors because no one else was doing it. And in fact, your organization, the Center for Policing Equity, or CPE, hosts the largest collection of police behavioral data in the world. Tell me about what this collection is, how you got it, and what you are learning from it.
So we started doing this with funding from the National Science Foundation in 2013 to start collecting the data. It was slow going at first, but as soon as folks realized that they could get information on how bad the disparities were, then there was a flood. And so now we have a pretty significant backlog of communities and departments that want our analyses.
And when you say data, you mean like what happened when the police arrest someone, or which neighborhood did they make most of their arrests, that kind of thing. And then you bring all this information to police departments and communities to analyze together.
Yeah, and there will be different appetites for change across different cities. There are folks in communities where we work where community has no interest in working with law enforcement. In other places where they want to grow law enforcement, and that's the only option that they're dealing with.
After a police department invites us in, we handle the legal stuff, we engage with the community, our next step is to analyze their data. And the goal of these analyses is to determine how much do crime, poverty, neighborhood demographics predict, let's say, police use of force. Okay, so let's say that those factors predict police will use force on this many black people. So our next question is, how many black people actually are targeted for police use of force? So what's up with the gap? Well, a big portion of the gap is the difference between what's predicted by things police can't control and what's predicted by things police can control, their policies and their behaviors. And what we're looking for are the types of contact or the areas in the city where that gap is biggest. Because then we can tell our partners, look here, solve this problem first.
So basically, if you see rates of police intervention well above the norm in any one neighborhood, it's worth looking into why, because maybe the problem is with how the policing is being done.
Yeah, so the analyses we do, we say, here is the raw disparity, and here is the portion that cannot be explained by poverty or crime. Let's say that you live in a city, and I tell you that black people are four times more likely to get beat up by the police than are white people. That's bad, that's unfair, but it doesn't really tell you how much you can solve by changing police behavior. as opposed to investing in those communities so they are not poor, giving folks mental health and substance abuse resources.
Mm.
It doesn't really get a sense at what portion of the problem is police policies and police behavior and what is everything else that happens to Black communities where there's cumulative concentrated disadvantage.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Black community that's like, everything here is great except for the police, right? We got plenty of clean water, all the jobs in the world, our schools are fantastic, it's just the cops. When you have vulnerable communities, they don't just have one problem, right? So when I tell you that 25% of the deadly shootings involve folks with serious mental illness, maybe you should stop doing some of that stuff. And what that means inevitably is maybe there should be funding for the people who can more appropriately respond to mental health, unhoused situations, substance abuse, child welfare. And that means police have a place that they should start and communities have a place to hold them accountable for the things they're doing wrong.
This brings us to something you wrote about in the Washington Post, the changes being made to the Ithaca Police Department in New York, where they are actually rethinking their approach to public safety and when armed officers are really needed to respond to a crisis, if they're even needed.
Yeah, so what's going on in Ithaca and Tompkins County, New York is absolutely extraordinary. So during the uprisings of 2020, in the wake of the lynching of George Floyd, they wanted to do something that was going to fundamentally change the way that public safety was delivered. When I say public safety, especially right now, lots of people are thinking, oh, he just means police. But for most folks, especially folks who live in vulnerable communities, public safety means literally the safety of the public. Do I know where I'm going to sleep tonight? Are my kids safe? So in Ithaca and Tompkins County, when they started having conversations around, well, how are we going to secure public safety? They asked questions about if we were to start over, start from scratch, how would we set up the municipal services that prevent the need for calling out in crisis and send the right resources when crisis comes? And I don't think what we would do is we'd have one person, an officer, who goes to a drug overdose, a mental health crisis, a kid who's missing school, a bank robbery, a domestic dispute. How much training would you need for that? That doesn't make any kind of sense. So instead, let's have folks who know how to respond to those things go to those things.
Yeah, so community outreach workers look like civilians on the street. We're not geared up or militarized. We don't carry guns.
This is community outreach worker Natalia Kowilich. She's part of a new public safety program still being developed in Ithaca.
We're just social workers who are coming at people with empathy, a need to connect, and help them get on with whatever they need to do.
Natalia responds to public safety crises, like the other day when she got a call to help a man who wouldn't cooperate with the police and EMTs.
This individual was kind of crumbled onto the sidewalk, really distressed, not able to engage. So I sort of walked over to them, sat down kind of close to them, seemed to be calming him down to have my presence there. And I kind of just started with him, like, what's going on? Do you know what's happening right now? And not surprisingly, he didn't know what was happening. He was freaked out by all of the flashing lights and loud noises and people in uniform coming at him. So just kind of getting clarity on what was happening was hugely helpful to this individual. I started talking to him more to kind of help him understand why the ambulance was there and why they wanted him to go to the hospital. After he had that conversation, he kind of came to a new understanding. And he was able to go up to the hospital knowing that he was safe and that there was reasons in place why he had to go. I think that if I wasn't there to keep the energy low and safe, I think that person would have freaked out. I don't think that they would have willingly gotten into the ambulance. I think they would have, unfortunately, perhaps even been in danger.
So, Philip, these initiatives in Ithaca, they make me, you know, think about the recent movement to defund the police, as people have called it. Do you see this, what's happening in Ithaca, as an example of what that could look like?
Yeah, so I think defund means different things to different people. I think part of the reason why it caught on in the way that it did, especially among young, newly politically engaged folks, is because it gave a target and it gave something concrete to do. And so instead of trying to make what we've got better, we need to reimagine. We need to make something different. Because if we can't imagine that a $20 crime shouldn't have someone with the authority to take away someone's life as a responder, then our crisis of imagination is literally deadly. So sure, this is what some folks might see as a way of defunding. Other folks would say, but there's not less money going in. It's more. And if you're not careful, this just becomes a bigger version of a police department. We're in a moment of great opportunity for experimentation. We should embrace that. We should make sure that we capture data on that. So when something doesn't work, we know what's a baby and what's bathwater when we start throwing things out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in this moment, there's the opportunity for really radical reimagining of the ways that we deliver public safety and the ways that we think about what does deliver public safety. And I think that's incredibly important. And I hope we don't squander this moment.
That's Philip Atiba Goff. He's the CEO of the Center for Policing Equity. You can find his full talk at TED.com. And we just want to mention that, like Ithaca, there are a number of towns and cities in the U.S. trying to redefine what public safety means for them. And on a recent ballot measure, Minneapolis voters rejected a proposal to replace their police department with a public safety department. Thank you so much for listening to our show today on Bucking the System. To learn more about the people who were on this episode, go to ted.npr.org. And to see hundreds more TED Talks, check out TED.com or the TED app. This episode was produced by Sylvie Douglas, James Delahousie, Rachel Faulkner, Katie Monteleone, and Harrison Vijay Choi. It was edited by Sanaz Meshkinpour. Our production staff at NPR also includes Jeff Rogers, Deba Motisham, Matthew Cloutier, and Fiona Guerin. Our audio engineer is Brian Jarboe. Our intern is Catherine Seifer. Our theme music was written by Ramteen Arablouei. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Colin Helms, Anna Phelan, Michelle Quint, and Micah Eames. I'm Manoush Zamarodi, and you've been listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.